Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we talk to an author of an exciting new book in the broader field of Islamic studies. Claire Pamant's book, Comic Performance in Pakistan, The Bhand, is a fantastic new book centered on the Punjabi art of the Bhand, or comic performance. Pamant explores the history and present of the Bhand and Bhand artists through a thoroughly interdisciplinary lens that engages performance studies, ethnography, history, and the study of religion. In our conversation on this wonderful new book, we talked about the pre-colonial Islamicate and colonial history of the Bhand, the way in which this genre complicates the boundaries of Hindu and Muslim folk art, ways in which the Bhand has disturbed and unsettled class and gender hierarchies in Pakistan, the political work performed by the Bhand, and the Bhand in the era of satellite television. This lyrically written book on a long-running and hugely important tradition of Islamicate humor will interest much scholars of Islam, South Asia, anthropology, and performance studies. Here now is my conversation with Professor Claire Pamant. Hello, Claire, how are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you, Ali Sher.
Thank you so much, Claire, for your time and for this wonderful and really important and interesting book. Really thoroughly enjoyed reading it and really opens up an important topic that about which not much is known. So I think your book has really made a very important intervention. We have a tradition on the New Books Network, Claire, that our first question is always biographical, where we're interested in learning more about the journeys of our authors. So I was wondering if you could share a bit with our listeners, Claire, about how you became a scholar, how you became interested in Pakistan, and in sort of the comic forms of expression in Muslim societies, and how did you get to write this particular book?
Thank you. Well, thank you again for bringing me onto this program. I think it's really important in the work of bringing work to a larger audience. I think beginnings are always slippery. I came to scholarship as a theater and performance practitioner, and I wear both scholarly and practitioner hats, which are often interchangeable in my work. Alas, I don't have my own performance history of clowning as a practitioner. Coming out of my MA in dramaturgy at Goldsmiths London, I was working in applied theatre, a lot of Boal and political activism, and also as a dramaturg, sometimes director, working a lot with young British South Asian writers like Kali Theatre, Birmingham Rep and Waterman's, through these companies and organisations that at that time, around 2003, we're giving a lot of space to the development of new work, particularly of a multicultural bent. And it was around that time that I got this phone call from the British Council of an opportunity to visit Pakistan with a young writer aimed at connecting cultures. And this was for a really short 5-day visit, so limited in its scope. And while we were there, we heard about Eve Ensler's Vagina Monologues going on in the capital. And at the same time in the press was the female dance ban on the popular Punjabi stage, which at that time was at its peak. But any conversation about that with the theatre practitioners we were meeting prompted wholesale dismissal. It was kind of impossible to find out really what was going on in the popular theatre at that time. We were largely plugged into parallel theatre makers who had formed in the 1980s in resistance to General Zia's Islamicization policies. And Boal and Brecht, practitioners I was very familiar with as a practitioner myself, their uses of these practitioners struck an immediate connection with my own work. And at that time, Fawzia Afzal Khan and Eugene Van Erven had given some space to these practitioners of the parallel theatre. But otherwise, there was little scholarship and certainly nothing that could explain the scripts of illegitimacy unfolding in the discrepant stages of Pakistani theatre. So these questions began scratching at that time. And I think at that time, the parallel theatre appeared heroic to me. They'd been fighting censorship. You know, I'd been doing some work in British theatre around censorship bills, which had hovered over the British stage until the late 60s. So the fights for censorship around General Zia's period were of interest. And these companies of the parallel theatre had taken the folk, which was a nomenclature for anything indigenous, suppressed as the story unfolded through them, through colonial modernity and lack of state support and outright cultural hostility. And they'd kept it alive, was the narrative that was being given. I went back to Pakistan through the British Council and worked with one parallel group. But like what has been said by Rustam Barucha, and also Aparna Dalvadkar of the IPTA movement in India and the Theatre of Roots, the folk seemed likewise to be figured as some empty vessel, that the indigenous practitioners had kind of died out and that there was a reconstruction of these forms to be filled with political content. When I was invited back again to teach, it was then that I got my first proper exposure to the Punjabi popular theatre, taking along with me my students, much to the chagrin of their families. I mean, this was just considered a low, degenerate and vulgar scene. But it was such a huge scene. I can't think of another instance in world theatre of recent decades where theatre has literally overtaken the cinema industry. I mean, this was a theatre that was playing in cinema houses and other spaces. And whatever had been said of the folk, I found to be here, with a great energy and connection with its audience. And very much the band at the center of that theater. So what was a 5 days residency in Pakistan ended up turning into a full 13 years residency. I was living and working in Pakistan. So it's been a long and immersive journey, which I will not plague you with the details of. But I suppose the band became a project when I was working with National College of Arts up in Rawalpindi a new campus opened during the Musharraf period. And this was envisioned as the first theater program in the public sector. And this was around 2006-2007. So I was initially involved in formulating curriculum, and myself and a consortium of theatre practitioners, you know, wanted this to be global in scope, but absolutely culturally grounded. So we had a festival, a consortium of scholars. There was Jamil Ahmed, who came over from Bangladesh, whose work at the time was Wishing for a World Without Theatre for Development. And he'd done a lot of work on the fluid transformations of various Hindu practices into Muslim contexts, which was, you know, a really important inspiration. And Kathy Foley was there, who'd worked on Southeast Asian comedy and clowning. And we had the brothers of the Niazi Gharana folk musicians, who we spent a couple of weeks ping-ponging between different villages on the outskirts of Faisalabad and Lahore, and also finding practitioners in those Punjabi cities. And it was there that, you know, this notion of the folk was very much alive, whether it was the storytelling Dastan Ugo, certain dance practices, and the band who were adapting very fluidly and comfortably between village performances, neighborhood performances, and main stage theater stages. And when we presented this and engaged conversation in public with these artists, I mean, it was so clear the folk was not dead, as I'd been kind of led to believe, only resuscitated by the parallel theater. I mean, it was alive and enjoying other circuits of economy. And it was shortly after that whole program, which was called Desi Natak, that I had my first long interview with Aman Ullah, who appears on the front cover of the book. He'd also performed in this festival. He was at the time, he traveled all the way up from Lahore to Rawalpindi for a performance, having to travel back all the way down to Lahore to meet his 11 p.m. start show on the popular theater stage. But this was a practitioner who was seen by many elite cultural custodians as the culprit of theater's downfall. And while he doesn't describe himself as a band, which has been absolutely dogged with low status associations, is widely acknowledged among his fellow comedians that he belongs to indigenous Marathi hereditary performance lineages. And we, in this first like big long interview, there was me, who had just come out of the library carrying a big pile of books and rather nervous about this long interview. And he told me that he himself was going to write a book titled Authenticity. And this was a joke at me and my persona. But I guess that was my beginning. I mean, the contested narratives of authenticity hanging over the stage, beleaguered by class and caste, and really trying to tell a story that would recover agency of these marginalized performers. And so the histories of the below.
Terrific. Thank you so much for that. I was wondering, Claire, since many of our listeners may not be familiar with this figure that forms the main center of this book, I was wondering if you could introduce our listeners to the figure of the Bhand and of its connection to Sufism and Islamic literature and culture. And as part of that answer, perhaps if you could also explain this key category that really binds this book, which is the Bhand mode, through which you demonstrate the flexibility and the dynamism of this form of folk art. So So sort of a two-part question to set the stage a bit for our listeners. Could you say a bit more about what is the Bahand, how is it connected to Islam and Sufism, and then what is this category of the Bahand mode?
So as a form, the Bahand is most recognized through wedding performances and in contemporary Pakistani Punjabi culture, although the Bahand has all kinds of incarnations across South Asia. In the wedding, you have a pairing, a male duo. One is the Ranga character, a straight man character who sort of plays the hierarchical figure. And then you have a bigla character who's the kind of wise, witty fool. They often enter a wedding, sometimes invited, sometimes unannounced, almost guerrilla-like. And between the two of them and their inscriptions of order and disorder, they locate various paradoxes in their environment. So they might come in and notice that Sher Ali is the host of this program and use Qasida to elevate status, the Ranga will, and then the Bigla will kind of begin to deflate that. So there's a play in repartee, jugats, of asserting and debunking, a balancing between praise and deflation, which begins to destabilize and play topsy-turvy with power. I look at this as a mode recognizing the transformations which prompted this very project. So in the popular theater, the duo might transform into the Chaudhry and a low, quote-unquote, caste Marathi character, a master and a servant, a boy with long hair who's just come out of American education, and the a witty, back-chatting female servant, for example. And this duo act has connections with many practices in Muslim worlds. Iran's Ruhozi, Siabazi have the Hodji character and the Sia character. There's Magad clowns in Afghanistan, practices in Tajikistan, and I think probably most widespread is the Hachifat and the Karagoj, which Landau has done some work on. I mean, like all the way Egypt, Syria, Turkey, Palestine, Tunisia, Algeria. So, of course, one can say there are universal traits of comedy, like these patterns also emerge in Western circus clowning, commedia dell'arte, right? Even Tom and Jerry. But I think in the field of theater studies, where notions of absence, I'm quoting John Bell here, in Muslim worlds that there is no theater and performance in Muslim worlds really continue to prevail. I teach world theater history and often pull out these passages, which are super problematic in the main textbooks of our discipline. South Asia is often presented in textbooks that Muslims arrived and killed theater. And I think there's been a lot of interest in comedy post 9/11, and these notions of absence have really been used to justify a lot of soft power of Western intervention. I start the book with the sort of spoof documentary, comic documentary, Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World by Albert Brooks, where he's on this pretend mission by the US government to discover what makes 300 million Muslims life in the region. And this was around the same time that the cartoons of the Prophet came out, which prompted a big discourse around absences of comedy in Muslim worlds. So in this film, he goes past the Red Fort in Delhi, and, you know, where once upon a time there was Raja Birbal, a jester with the 16th century Akbar, but he doesn't mention any of that. Instead, it's this notion of great sobriety. So I wanted to intervene and really point to specific genealogies at play that explain for the continued persistence of these comic modes, which are transformational. So while in history the figure of the band is a marginal entity, bands do keep popping up in the historical chronicle. And while you have contemporary bands performing in the wedding, who are relegated to rather low status designations, who suggest a kind of revisionist history of a glorious past of a stable court jester, such as Raja Birbal, they will quote as, a once glorious status they enjoyed down to a modern fall. Sikh rulers are brought up in the mix as well. I don't think they enjoyed such a stable jester type presence, but bands do appear named from 14th century Delhi Sultanate right through to Wajid Ali Shah in Lucknow, and you get this, what I call a play between the centers and the margins. So you often find them kind of on the threshold of power. They're sometimes in the court, they're sometimes out in the street. There's a discussion about how they should stay out in the bazaar and not interfere with the court. They don't have any sort of clear place, but they're there, they're around. So from there, as a comic mode, I dig deeper into Sufi moorings of this character that might explain the license of these appearances, and I pull out the comic tropes that undergird some of the wise forefigures who pop up in Arabic and Persian, Central Asian context, from Ashab to Balul to Mullah Nasruddin, otherwise known as Jua. And this kind of search was also directed by contemporary performers who ascribe spirituality to their work, you know, particularly a wedding band like Munir Hussain from Lahore. So he talks about the dervish character, the fakir, as a fankar, the wandering Sufi seeker is like a fankar, like a contemporary artist. Someone who doesn't stay in any one place, who doesn't get folded into power and the freedom and abandon in that. He has a lovely quote where he says, "Whatever comes out of our mouth is a confident prayer. It's like we're talking to Allah, a wired connection." So the sense of being connected with the divine, of the artistic license in that. And then he in particular also talks about healing. And this is a trope that goes back to images of the soul and some of the Sufi wise fool literature, of provoking reflection within and the cleaning of the soul. I think there's also connections with Malamati Sufis and this also is pulled from some of the contemporary anecdotes, you know, taking on the blame, transgressing social norms, and forming an existential relationship with God, which might invite social opprobrium and invert contemporary, invert various hegemonies and hierarchies, but gets its divine divine license. And I think divine judgment is also a strong theme which keeps popping up in the work of contemporary wedding bands. I began my fieldwork proper in 2007 when legitimacy and military actions of President Musharraf were very much being put to question. And so there's this pairing in Lahore who say, "Today I went to the hereafter and met Israel. He was wailing and crying," the Ranga says. "Why was he wailing and crying?" The Bigla says, "I asked him, 'Why are you crying? You are the angel of death. God has given you a great duty. You can take life.' Ranga, 'Indeed he can. Why then was he crying?' Bigla says, 'The angel told me my duty has been taken away from me.' The Ranga says, 'Really? Then who has taken it?' Bigla says, 'General Musharraf.' And they slap. The Chamota slap is used as a leather slapstick to punctuate the punchline, but also as if to punish the joker. So I think these the juggling between mundane power and putting mundane power literally in the heavens on trial is a strong connection of those Sufi lineages which hark back all the way to the Sufi wise fool who hovers between history and legend.
Terrific. Now let's continue this theme of the historical narrative or trajectory of the Bhand. And if I could sort of combine a couple of questions to do with this history. First is, I mean, we've already touched on a bit of this, but perhaps you could speak a bit more about the ways in which the figure of the Bhand transforms from the pre-colonial Islamicate South Asia to colonial South Asia. And also, if I was wondering if you could speak a bit about one theme of one of the chapters in your book, which is the convergence of Brahmin and Sufi literature when it comes to the figure of the Bhand, and how that sort of complicates neat divisions between Hindu and Muslim modes of comedy and so on. So I was wondering if you could combine those two threads of your analysis in terms of the transition from pre-colonial to colonial South Asia and this convergence between Brahmin and Sufi literature, and in relation to the figure of the Bhand.
Yeah. So on the one hand, some forms of elite patronage evidently crumbled. You know, the emperors and the nawabs were no longer there for the Bhands with those colonial interventions. But because this was not the only patronage, because the Bhand was not relegated to only being a court jester, it didn't stamp out the Bhand's work. But on the other hand, with colonial modernity, you have a great rigidity of class caste constructs. And you really see this vis-a-vis the colonial classifications held onto Bhands, Marasis, Bhats, Bare Rupias, which I suggest in the historical chronicle see all kinds of intersections and convergences. But the British, they really tried to fix the Bhand as low. Even then, you still see the figure poking around and confusing the designations. So in some of the great, you know, caste and tribes manuals, you get someone like Ibbotson in the early 20th century, who's ascribing on one hand like a quasi-sacred character, but on the other hand, very, very low. Like, they don't know where to put them. And I think there's a great account from Kashmir, of the travel figure, a travel writer, Walter Lawrence, who kind of speaks his wrath towards this banned figure that he meets. And probably this stems from his own encounter with one. You know, he says that they're not quite sane. He says one was this Muslim who had been formerly a tutor to a high official and was hopelessly given to drinking. He reviled me in the strongest language when I refused to give him whiskey and said that the Iron Age of the Hindus had indeed arrived, and he left my camp in tears. And this prompts then this wholesale dismissal from Lawrence of these degenerate characters. But what you see in the text of this is like the band is really messing with conventional categorizations, like the band is a Muslim, but he's given to drinking, he was a tutor, and yet he's supposed to be really low, and he rebukes the high colonial officer all the while through doing this. In terms of Urdu literature in the late 19th and early 20th century, there's some mirroring of this. I mean, in terms of projections of crassness, vulgarity, a sort of banishing of the band, but there are other accounts which really romanticize the band and like portray the band as this resistance to colonial rule, a kind of a memory machine who's bringing out these lost liminal possibilities of Mughal rule. And you have Sharer, who gives this lovely depiction of an apparently famous band in Delhi known as Kerala. When he gets banished out of the 18th century Muhammad Shah Rangila's court, he appears up this tree with his dholki drum, like clambering out of the earthly regions of mundane powers to be closer to the creator. And, you know, there's all kinds of liminal and rather ambivalent possibilities. You know, the bands can appear anywhere, even up trees. So in terms of complicating divisions between Hindu and Muslim modes of comedy, I think what little work has been done on the band in other regions, which, as I noted, takes like different contemporary forms. You've got Kashmiri band patter, and you know the late Kemu practitioner, but also wrote like rather substantial history for these band patter performers. Posits the band as a Hindu lineage, although many of the performers he was working with were Muslim. And then you've got like work that is by John Emig on a Rajasthani band, Behrupia, who claims Muslim lineages, although the performer he's working with is actually a Hindu. And I think that itself shows, you know, a crisscrossing. And I think the framing of either Hindu or either Muslim has really been used to foster nationalist narratives. So, you know, part of my project is intervening in the narrative of Islam as a repressive force to performance. But I'm also cautious of replicating the kind of hegemonies that have gone on in Indian theater of then glorifying Hindu Sanskrit roots. I don't want to do the same with Islam. And I think that someone like Birbal in 16th century Akbar's court, I mean, explicitly confuses these paradigms. You've got a Hindu Brahmin jester, as he's often named, in a Muslim, although the pluralistic religious court of Akbar. So these figures of Sufi wise fools, of Ashar, Balul, Nasruddin, this kind of divine madness and being beyond law, beyond mundane, as a mode to redress worldly authority. On the other hand, you've got in Sanskrit plays, and I'm really calling on other people's scholarship here, like the Vidushek and the Vita of the Bana plays. I mean, there's an etymological sharing of these particular plays where jester characters do take on Brahmin status. And there's an implicit muddling. I'm not claiming any clear origin narrative, but stories evidently flow into each other in literature. You've got virtually the same stories from 8th, 9th century Medina, such as Ashab with his honeyed tongue, who sort of gets the better of his mother. You get the same story replicated in Birbal narratives of the jester using honey to get his uppance upon Akbar. And similarly, you find the flow of like Nasruddin stories into Bahand accounts. You know, the wonderful, wonderful story of the headstrong Timur, who's, I think, having his having some haircut or something, and he looks in the mirror and he sees how he's aging and begins weeping, and everyone in the court weeps with him. And then when Timur stops, everyone else stops except for Nasruddin, who keeps on weeping. And when asked why, he's told, you have to look at yourself in the mirror for such a short time, but I have to look at you every day. That's why I'm weeping. You find virtually the same anecdote of a Bahand centuries later. So I see an active flow.
Let's now shift to the Bahand in Pakistan. And you've already touched on a bit of this when you talked about the play in which Musharraf was being critiqued, etc. But I was wondering if you could speak a bit more about the ways in which the Bahand has disturbed and unsettled sort of class and gender hierarchies in Pakistan through performances in varied settings like weddings, but also then more sort of theatres, local theatres, but sometimes even more national theatres, etc. So I was wondering if you could speak a bit about these performances in these different venues and how the kind of political and social work that is also performed as part of these Bahand comic performances.
Yeah, so I mean, Musharraf does hang over the book. It was very important in the period I began the work. When I had my first full interaction with the real maestro, Hadi Munir Hussein, and his sons, they were doing jokes out on the street. They were playing jubbets, and it was Wera Nawaz and Shahbaz, PMLN rulers who had at the time had been exiled out of Pakistan, and they were trying to come back in to contest the next elections, and Musharraf wasn't letting them back. And so where have they gone? They went to Saudi Arabia, then they went to London. They started asking all the barbers, can you make our hair grow back? It's kind of the two brothers are known to be bald, and this becomes a symbol of political impotence in the realm of power politics. But all the foreign doctors refuse because their heads have been shaved off by General Musharraf. So what appears to be going on here is a kind of heralding up of the PMLN rulers against against military might. But then as you scratch away and It took me some time to scratch away at this. These Bahands would claim to have been performing once upon a time for Nawaz Sharif and Shahbaz Sharif and the PMLN family. And they actually were back in the 90s. And so very much like the historical Bahá'ís, they would appear to these politicians and they give these wonderful examples and they're still telling these jokes out into the streets around this election period of the 2007-2008 period. You know, so they go and they're there to cheer up the Nawaz Sharif's father, and they ask, you know, where does all the food go in the country? It's eaten by Nawaz Sharif, and where does all the flour go to this grandson of Nawaz Sharif, Saxon Sax? He's a gutter without a cover. So I mean, there's real political work going on here, and an important part of Bahá'í performances in such weddings and familial environments is a demand of veil. The award given by audience members to these performers. So there's this performative act of sharing wealth when power, wealth accumulation is being explicitly critiqued. But these are exceptions rather than the rule. I mean, for many Bahá'ís who don't have such powerful supporters, they are locked into really rigid class stratifications that have been inherited vis-a-vis the processes of colonial modernity. And so you find Bahá'ís bursting into weddings and ripping out genealogies that the upwardly mobile would prefer to forget. For those who are really confined to low status patrons and live very, very poor lives in makeshift tents and slum areas, etc., you know, they're really scoffing at power, really from the underbelly of society. I mean, so similar themes, it's uneven economy, scoffing at political power. You've got Saudi Arabia, you've got load shedding, you've got a lot of scatological references and a lot of bored going on in those performances. And I think that's really also your entrance of the Bahá'í mode to the theatre. Like, the theatre, really up to the 70s, was scripted in colonial-esque Eurocentricity. A lot of carryover in terms of the style and the scripts that were being performed by rather elite custodians. And so the Bahá'í begins like knocking at the door of this theatre, squeezing in, bringing in local characters and content. And these are performers like Aman Ullah who don't necessarily belong to Bahá'í lineages, but very much carry the mode forward. So this theatre developed full grounding during General Zia's 1980s. And I think that's political. They really did begin to indigenize the stage, and as I said, prompted this like rapid growth, taking over cinema houses, etc. But it's important to note that the band isn't revolutionary. So there'll be a topsy-turvy play with power hierarchies, but the band mode can become deeply hegemonic as well. And so after the 80s, producers began to put women performers, and there were earlier precedents for this, but there was a release dance which had been suppressed during General Zia's period. Was now kind of being hurled onto the stage, producers looking to make money out of scantily clad women performers, shaking up the illicit. And, you know, quickly those performers became much more popular than the male band-like comedians. And so, such as when I arrived in Pakistan, there was this collusion going on between those male performers and the government in trying to ban these women from the stage. And women themselves, and you know, this has been going on even General Zia's period, had been adapting the band mode to insert them into this particular repertoire. So you see like women taking on tomboy characters and then outwitting the male comedians. So yeah, lots and lots of transformations.
Speaking of transformations, towards the end of your book, you also talk about the ways in which the band both benefited from and intervened in the emerging erupting Pakistani satellite TV industry that really saw a massive boom in the late 2000s or early 2000s, etc. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about that. How did this satellite TV industry boom affect the figure of the band, and how it became part of a certain television arena?
Yeah, so this begins in 2008 with the newly inaugurated Pakistan People's Party. And there's this absolute flowering, flourishing plethora of television channels, which had begun in Musharraf's period. But it became particularly noisy, what many people have called a circus, and pretty hostile. I mean, the PEMRA regulations on the ethical parameters of the media have not, I don't think they've even still set in. It was like a very violent debate going on, glasses being thrown around TV studios. Producers, I think, saw the band as a way of bringing the news and kind of finding a comic entrance away from the hostility to bring news to the quote-unquote common people. And with this, they saw a kind of dumbing down of the news, which leaves way for all kinds of like simplifications and propagandist messages of the media, and using the band to try and glorify certain politicians. And this was particularly true of Hass Bihal. But I think when the band mode works best, and what Sohail Emma did with that program was that he was not going to be confined to simply bombing down the news, but actually intervene to complicate the news and the media messages at times. So what began to shape up in that format, which has changed over time too, was that the journalist became the Ranga character and the band became the Bigla character. And through that dialogic interface, there was a contestation of the news. And sometimes that unfolded into a politician Ranga and the band like Sohail Ahmed as the Bigla. The television comedy has expanded in proportions which are beyond my count at the moment. What we see in this kind of contemporary television comedy is that it's almost like the band has taken over entirely. Some of the journalists have been pushed out and you get these, it's not just one man on the sofa playing a band, you get an entire studio of bands. And that actually gives very little for them to rebuttal from. As I say, it's not revolutionary. There's ambivalence always in the band's work. I think the current project I'm segging my way into at the moment is to look at the kind of hegemony entailed therein. I'm presently working on Khwajasara Hijra performances, and you see these Hijras and Khwajasaras absolutely being belittled by some of these male comedians on these stages. So sometimes it can be very politically critical, and sometimes it can be deeply hegemonic.
So as we're coming towards the end of our time, Claire, you just began talking about this, but I was wondering if you want to say a bit more about what's the next project? You've said a bit about it, but do you want to explain a bit more what the next project is?
Yes, I would love to. So the next project, it feels an old project. I've been working on it for a couple of years at least. I explore another dimension of Pakistan's marginalized performance repertoire through gender variant communities known as Hijras or Khwajasaras, a third gender term adopted in Pakistan after human rights hearings of 2009. So this is work I began before the rights hearings, left it to concentrate on my book. And then came to it after these rights hearings. So I'm interested in how performances by these communities intersects and rubs against a rather classist human rights activism in Pakistan's neoliberal left. And I'm particularly interested in performances of piety by this community and how they transfer embodied community knowledge, identity, serving as modes of activism, and also constructing new ethical dispositions. So I'm looking across conventional theater, dance, political activism, and religious ritual. I'm looking for performances at Sufi shrines, in public spaces, in streets and homes. And really looking at how these performances still continue to remain on the margins despite the emerging human and civil rights movements.
Comic Performance in Pakistan, The Bard by Claire Pement, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you so much, Claire, for your time, for this wonderful book that I think should be read by scholars of South Asia, Islam, Pakistan, performance studies, really a wonderful intervention. So thank you for this, and thank you so much for your time today in sharing some of your thoughts and insights about this book with the New Books Network. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sher Ali.
So this was my conversation with Professor Claire Pement on her wonderful new book, Comic Performance in Pakistan, The Bard. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. And I hope you will also join us next time for another new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies. Bye-bye now.